with kids, isn't it true that we sort of need to get into their business a little because it's our job to help shape them?
Well, it is certainly different being in my partner's business versus being in my child's business. I think there is a misunderstanding about what it means to be out of someone's business. We mistakenly believe that it means I don't care, but we care even more intimately when we are out of their business.
Welcome to Habits for Your Happily Ever After, where we get clear about your marriage communication. Because when your relationships are strong, you're able to concentrate at work, reduce conflict at home, and receive support for your dreams so that you have the courage to live your best life. I'm Rebecca Mullen, a relationship coach living in Western Colorado, and today we'll hear from Allison Evans again. Allison is a master certified life coach and the creator of Be the Heroine, a year-long small group coaching program. You'll hear about the age-old frustration with nourishing your kids and how difficult it is to find the line between leadership as a parent versus fostering your child's independence. If you've ever wondered when to intervene with your child and when to let go and trust them to know what's good for themselves, this episode is for you.
Allison Evans, I'm so glad to have you back. And this week we get to talk about why kids drive us crazy. And so we want to control them.
Hi, Rebecca. I'm so glad to talk about this with you. It's a fun topic.
Yeah. I think that we get in the way of controlling our kids because we have the best of intentions, right? We want to be good parents. We want to keep the door of possibility open for our kids. We want to give them every advantage possible. So we sign them up for soccer and theater and journalism class and making sure that they have all the right play dates. And then they're exhausted. So I want to talk about that sort of hyper-involvement. And I also want to talk about discipline. Because last time we talked to you, we got to talk about staying in our own business when it comes to our romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. That feels much more straightforward. It's sort of like they're a grown-up. Of course, we have to stay in our own business. But with kids, isn't it true that we sort of need to get into their business a little because it's our job to help shape them?
Well, it is certainly different being in my partner's business versus being in my child's business. We have a different responsibility to our children than we have to our partner. And so I think, you know, like we talked about last time, I think there is a misunderstanding about what it means to be out of someone's business. We mistakenly believe that it means I don't care. Mm-hmm. We mistakenly believe it means I'm out, you're on your own. But we care even more intimately when we are out of their business, staying in ours and beside them, whether it's our partner or our children.
This is the glory of what I think you have to offer us, is this distinction between I don't care and I'm in my own business. Can you talk some about how you can care about your child and not be in their business? What's that distinction like when in your life?
I can offer a few examples. One struggle that I had with my son was that he seemed only to eat the air. He just had a very small appetite. And strangely, he seemed also not to like the food that I prepared. he seemed to prefer things that came in packages and cans and that were brightly colored. All of the foods that I vehemently disapproved of were his favorites. And when I would prepare wholesome food, he would just nibble around the edges and I would be so hurt. And also, so not only was I hurt, I believed that he was hurting himself by choosing those junk foods, so-called junk foods, over my wholesome cooking. And so it was something we really struggled over for years. And, you know, there is something fundamental about feeding one's child, right? It just doesn't, it hardly gets more fundamental than that.
It's primal.
It's primal, yes. It's
yeah.
Primal. And so I felt justified in being judgmental about the kind of food that he preferred and the fact that he did not prefer what I considered to be wholesome food. And so here's the distinction. When I am judgmental about what he is doing, he's going to feel it. And so if he acquiesces to what I want, if he surrenders control and cedes control to me and allows me to control him, he may be getting the food into his body, but he's not going to like it. He's going to feel bad. And it's at best a short-term victory for me. The judgment underneath the two of us is my son shouldn't eat that food, shouldn't mm-hmm. eat junk food. Mm-hmm. He should eat home cooking. Mm-hmm. That is a judgment that I feel in my body as tension, tightness, no breathing. And I make a face and I treat him like I don't treat him very kindly. I think I'm doing the right thing, but in fact, I do not treat him with kindness and respect and friendliness. And that is corrosive to our relationship, much more corrosive to our relationship than a packet of Doritos. So what I did about 100 times during his growing up years, because now he's in college, was I would do the work on the thought he should or he shouldn't. He should like my food. He should eat what I prepare. He shouldn't eat that junk, etc. And when I do that, when I do the work on that thought, what I see is, of course he should. Of course he should like junk food because all of his friends like it. It's delicious. It's engineered for deliciousness and to want the eater to just keep eating one more and one more and one more. So is it true he shouldn't eat that stuff? Well, it must not be true because it's engineered to delight. And so when I release, because when I, through the work, I'm able to look at things more clearly, look at a situation and my thinking. And so when I realize, of course he should like it, of course he should eat it, because it's just what people his age do and it delights the taste buds. So when I relinquish that thought, and I think, of course he should, then I relax in my body and I can laugh with him. I can say, yeah, babe, I get it. Doritos are the bomb. And this food is so good for your body. So I'm going to put this down. And
My home cooked food.
Exactly. I'm going to put my wholesome home cooked food prepared with love down in front of you and just ask you to try it. And the Doritos will always be there. I promise I won't steal them away from you. The energy of that request, Rebecca, goes miles further with my child, both now, it's going to, my relaxation is going to help him to relax, so we're not locked in our positions. And it is nutritious to our relationship rather than toxic. The toxicity of me judging him for, you know, doing what's just pretty normal and natural for kids today. So it is about changing the energy between us. That is fundamentally what it means to be out of my child's business. What's funny sounding anyway is that I encourage parents of every age, parents of children of every age to judge their children. And by that, I mean, there is a form for understanding our judgments of other people in the work called the Judge Your Neighbor Worksheet.
This is something that we'll point to on Byron Katie's website.
Yes, we will. And but I just, when I say that I encourage people to judge their children, no matter what age they are, I mean it. I have found it to be liberating.
People are very scared, at least in my coaching practice, if they don't know, if they've never seen the results of the work. The first time I invite them to judge their, especially their kid, they back away. Can you talk about the difference between being a judgmental parent and taking time to fill out a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet and getting clear on what those judgments are like? And just to draw a line of distinction, there is, when it comes to Byron Katie's work, the work, there are the four questions, which are the meditation. And then there is this separate Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, which is what you're talking us through.
Yes, exactly. There is a world of difference between being a judgmental in your business parent, in my kid's business parent, and being a parent who judges their child on paper and then does the work on the judgments. The former, which is just to be judgmental, is where most people, or where people often live. And that includes of their children, even though they don't like to admit it.
And our judgments hide, like in, I just want the best for my child. I want to give my child every advantage.
Oh, absolutely.
Those are the little disguises that judgment wears.
Yes, yes. And God bless us. The thing is, these two things are true at once, or a multitude of things are true at once. I do want the best for you. I do want your body to thrive on a healthy, wholesome food. I do want you to enjoy what you eat and enjoy your life and be free. I want all of that. And I think I know how to do it. So when you oppose me, or when you oppose my agenda, when it comes to how you should spend your time, with whom, and what you should put into your body, then my instinct, because I think I know best, my instinct is to be judgmental and then to try to control. So all of these things are true, that we can have judgments of our children and we can want the best for them. I am not that interested in all of the ways that you want the best for your child, because I just am taking that for granted. And when I say I mean I as a coach.
Yeah.
I'm interested in a coaching session to talk to that part of the parent who is frightened and controlling.
And desperate to change their child. Like, I just need you to help me change my child.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's real a clue that I, as a parent, am in my child's business if I'm saying to you, please help me change my child. They won't listen to me. I try to discipline them. I try to eat them to eat good food. They won't listen to me.
100%, yes.
Tell us about what it's like to fill out that Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. How does that help?
So I love the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. It is like, I think of it as a clear acrylic box. And I just tuck a thought into the box, and then I can hold it up to the light, and I can turn it all around, and I can look at it from lots of different perspectives. In the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, you look at one moment from multiple perspectives. First, you look at what happened, like just the facts. So in the example from before, my child is not eating his dinner. He's just moving the food around. So question one is, what have they done and how do you feel about it? And so you write the facts. I'm frustrated with my son because he's not eating his dinner, for example.
Right.
In question two, I say what I want him to do. In question three, I advise him, what should he do? So question two, what do I want? What would make me happy? I want him to eat his food. Question three, I get to say what he should do, should or shouldn't do. He shouldn't move his food around the plate. He should put the food in his mouth and he should like it. Chew it up and swallow it and say, yum, yum, you know, whatever I think he should do. Question four is, what do I need in order? And this is one of my favorite questions on the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, because in this one, you say what you need in order to be happy. And this isn't what I would settle for. This is what would really just take the lid off and make me happy. So in this scenario, I need him to love this food. You know, in order for me to be really happy, I need him to love this food. And I need him to hate junk food.
So, and what that does for me as a parent is it validates that part of me that wants to feed, that has that primal urge to feed my kid. And so when they want to eat my food, it just validates everything inside of me that prepares.
Yes. And what I love, and there are two more questions which I'll address, but one of the things I love about the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet and the work itself is it really just gives voice to the full range of, you know, what makes me angry or frustrated or whatever emotion or emotions I'm feeling, and to my aspirations. So I aspire to him loving my food so that it's effortless to get this child of mine to eat healthy, wholesome things that will nourish his body, and then he'll live forever and be happy, you know?
So, why does it help so much for you to be able to see all of those thoughts plainly? Why does that help us to unbox them?
Well, it gives voice to what's already happening inside. So those judgments are inside and those yearnings are inside, but we tend to cut off those edges or squish them into some middle way. Like, would you just eat three bites, please? Would you just try it, please? So we squash the judgment and the aspiration into this narrow band of what we would settle for. And when we get our way, when we get them to do what we would settle for, the trouble is it doesn't make us happy and it doesn't make them happy. So exploring the edges of our yearning as well as our judgment, just it loosens us up. So question five is often the hardest one to answer, because it's where you ask the person who is suffering, what do you think of them? Make a list, be petty and judgmental. So my child is stubborn, lazy,
uncaring about how uncaring. He works in his body.
Exactly. So it's all of the judgments in adjective form. It is what we really, and obviously just to refresh everyone's memory, lest they become alarmed at this point in the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. I know that you love, admire, and respect your child too, but that's not the part of you that's suffering right now. The Judge Your Neighbor worksheet is where you give voice to the part of you that is suffering, that is suffering because you are at war with reality, whether that reality is, you know, your spouse or your child or your dog.
Yeah.
Whatever is causing your suffering, that's what you're judging.
And oftentimes when we're having feelings that would be helped by a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, we don't feel like we're suffering. At least at my house, I feel like I'm right and they are wrong.
Gosh, Rebecca, that happens here too. So strange. Suffering is Byron Katie's catch-all. Byron Katie, the originator of the work. It is her catch-all for when I am arguing with reality. So she has a lingo. She's very plain spoken, but there are certain words that she repeats a lot, and one of them is suffering.
And arguing with reality is just this gorgeous idea that has taken me years to understand. But it really is about those moments in my life. Like, we'll just stick with the example of trying to feed a toddler. The toddler's not eating. Mm-hmm. And no matter how delicious I may think that food is or how hungry I think that toddler is, mm-hmm. I can't make a toddler eat. Even though I may be right mm-hmm. that little toddler needs to eat. Mm-hmm. And that's when I'm arguing with reality. And that's when I get worked up and, like you said, tight, and I'm not breathing, and I'm at war with my little kid. And I don't know a young parent who hasn't felt this at one level or another.
Oh my, no, I don't either. I don't know anyone who has I don't know anyone who's sailed through parenting unscathed. It is indeed a spiritual practice, because it continually prompts us to dig deep. We thinking of spade work again, you know, we dig deep to provide for our children in the basic ways, and then they are inconvenient because they disagree with us over something. They make things hard, or, you know, whatever it is, they thwart our best laid plans. And we have to dig deeper to find that pocket of love where we can give, you know, from that congruent place again.
Tell us about question six.
Okay, question six is, what is it about this situation or this person that you do not ever want to experience again? So you answer it saying, I refuse to, or I never want to blank. And question six is a lovely way to end the worksheet, because it, you know, after you've written those five questions that precede question six, you really are quite opened up, quite soft. And question six is, it emerges as the question of our greatest yearning, the thing that we want to be free from. And so it's a really beautiful place to end the worksheet as well as the work. We never start with question six. We always save question six for the end. The rest of it, you can move around. You can do question five first if you like, or question three first. But I tend to like to just, as they say, start at the top and work your way down.
And when I get to, I never want to argue with my toddler over food again. That's mm-hmm. what I would say, mm-hmm. but it's not realistic.
So, I mean, we're kind of, you know, getting into spoiler territory. But I'll tell you that, you know, when we do the work, which you've mentioned already is four questions, which the work is a meditation and you meditate on these four questions. And then the next part of the work is the turnarounds. The turnarounds are also a meditation, but a little more interactive with the facilitator. But you turn questions, excuse me, in the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, statements 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5, you turn them all around in a specific way, and it's all the same. But when you get to question six, the first turnaround is, I am willing. So I am willing to argue with my toddler about food again. Mm-hmm. And with the turnaround, when you state the opposite, you look for evidence that it might be true. So, Rebecca, why might it be true that I'm willing to have to argue with my toddler about food again?
Because it's so important to feed that toddler.
Yeah, I'm willing because it's probably going to happen again. Mm. And so what happens to you, Rebecca, when you experience that turnaround in the evidence? What happens in your body when you say, I am willing to argue with my toddler again?
I do notice a little bit of softening. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That clenching feeling I had when I was like, I'm sick of you arguing with me. Mm-hmm. I recognize, I'm willing because it's so important to me that my toddler eats that mm-hmm. I'm willing to go through this again. I'm not happy about it. I'm willing.
Okay. So that softening is a win. That is allowing some congruence from body into mouth, you know? And then the second turnaround to question six is, I look forward to arguing with my child. Now, I just want to remind listeners that we never start with question six. We always do more work in preparation for question six, because to say I'm willing and I look forward to this thing that I never want to experience again, that's a really hard ask of anyone before you've done the rest of the worksheet.
So take me through some work. I will pretend that I'm back 30 years ago when I had toddlers. And in fact, I remember a very specific moment with my son when he wouldn't eat. And it's just one of the embarrassing moments of my life as a mother. I think my judgment is my son should eat the food I prepare. I know, I mean, it's just like what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. I can relate to that at various stages of my parenting journey.
Okay, Rebecca. So when we do the work, we anchor the judgment in a very specific moment. So I invite you to go back in time to the moment where you were suffering acutely over this food problem. Mm-hmm. And so where were you?
I was in our house in Omaha. I was by myself. I was the only parent home. I was regularly the only parent home making food. And I really cared about feeding our children well. And we had very little budget to make that happen. And and I felt so righteously indignant about how hard I worked to make that food tasty and nutritious and appealing. Mm-hmm. And my son didn't want it. He was three.
Okay, so there you were in your house in Omaha, just you and the two kids. And your son isn't interested in the food you've prepared. What's he doing?
He's playing games and turning the food into toys and spreading it around, or maybe even, moving it around the table such that he's a jokester, right? So he's being jokey with this food that I'm trying to get him to eat. And his joking, rather than lightening me up, I'm getting tighter and tighter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you ready to do the work?
I'm ready.
Okay. So in this moment, Rebecca, my son should eat the food that I prepare. See yourself in that moment. And the thought arises, my son should eat the food I prepare. Is it true that he should eat the food you prepare?
Oh, Allison, it felt so true at the time. I have the luxury of time right now, but my gosh, it felt so true. Yes, it's true.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please be in that moment. It's what is remarkable to me, one of the things that is remarkable to me about the work is how I can revisit moments from my history that were painful and see new things. So even if I've done the work on it before, even if I have a different perspective, if I revisit the scene and honestly do the work on it, I often see things that I didn't see before. So, all right. Question two of the work, Rebecca, is, can you absolutely know or be certain that my son should eat the food I prepare in this moment?
No.
Mm-hmm. Where do you find that no?
I can see that he wasn't hungry. I can see that he didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And that's so, even now I'm choked up about it because it felt so personal to me that he didn't like the food that I had worked so hard for. But he was three. and we can't control what we like. No. And he wasn't, appetite is the best seasoning, and he wasn't hungry enough to eat something he didn't like.
Right.
What's great about being a three-year-old is that you know exactly what you like and what you don't like, and you're not confused yet by all those other messages that you get later in life. Mm-hmm. And he was pure in knowing what he wanted.
Yeah. Thank you. Right. Let's do question three. Question three is, how do you react? What happens when you believe in this moment, the thought, my son should eat the food I prepare? So how does it feel in your body? Let's just take, question three has sub questions, and I'm just going to ask you the sub questions. So how does it feel in your body?
So tight that I exploded. I exploded. Yep.
So, and what emotions do you experience when you believe this thought that may not even be true, that you're believing it in that moment?
I felt so hurt, and I felt so alone and frustrated and mad. I was mad that I couldn't make him like what I had worked so hard for.
Thank you. And how do you treat him in that moment when you believe my son should eat the food I prepare and he's not doing that? How do you treat him?
So this is the hardest part. I was mean.
Mm-hmm.
Now I remember when I told you that he was sort of playing and goofing around with the food, he was goofing enough to throw it on the floor. And I was mean. And I said that he had to eat it off the floor.
Mm-hmm. I'm right there with you, Rebecca.
I know that every parent has a moment like this, but it just hurts to see. It hurts me for my poor little son, and it hurts me for my 30-something self that I was. It's just hard to be a parent.
Yeah. So how do you, when you believe this thought that is at war with reality,
right,
that may not even be true, the thought is my son should eat the food I prepare, when you believe that thought, how do you treat yourself?
I'm having trouble seeing how I treat myself, because all I can see is how I treated him and how mean I was to him. What else do I need to look for so I can see how I treated myself?
So you've said that you feel tight in your body, that you explode.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel terrible. So is it, if I were doing that to you, Rebecca, would you call that kind or would you call that unkind?
Yeah, no, I was putting so much pressure on myself. Like I was telling myself, it is your job to get this kid to eat this food. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't. And so I guess I was treating myself in a way of, I was asking myself to do something that was just not going to happen.
You were asking yourself to do something impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it felt, it had that level of importance of, if I don't do this, his life is ruined. You know, like I'm telling myself, this is it. This, if you don't do this, you're a lousy mom. Mm.
So yes. You put a lot of pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
You give yourself an impossible task and you make the stakes really, really high.
Really, really high. Yeah.
And you're believing.
I globalized. So the way I treated myself was, I globalized. It wasn't a moment about three bites of food. It was a moment about the kind of human being he was going to become for all eternity.
Right. Yeah, that's what we do.
Yep.
That's what the mind does. And Rebecca, you're believing the thought, my son should eat the food I prepare, and he's not. What images from the past and the future come to your mind when you believe that thought?
Well, there is a host of my own food issues, right? Okay. So I have an eating disorder. And so that is very well controlled at this stage of my life, but that I was only newly capable in that moment. So I had a host of eating disordered ways of seeing, if he doesn't eat wholesome food, he's going to have his own eating disorder. So I was both drawing from the past, my circumstances, and then projecting into his future life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Heavy. There's a lot going on at this little table.
For this poor little three-year-old and his sweet mommy, who was honestly trying the best I could.
Right. Of course. And this is your work, but I'll tell you what would have happened. What did happen at similar times for me was what my parents always told me when I didn't want my food was, you should be grateful.
Right.
And boy, all of the shame that I felt about being an ingrate, I projected onto my children when they didn't eat the food. Mm. And so there's a lot going on at these tables.
Yep.
So, and I thought, if I couldn't get away with it, they shouldn't be able to. Right. That's fair, right?
Fairness. Fairness is a big part of all of these thoughts. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, Rebecca. So question 3, my son should eat the food I prepare. This thought, does it bring you stress or peace?
Stress.
Can you think of a stress-free reason to keep the thought? In other words, do you feel like if you let it go, something might happen?
I don't, when you say, if I let it go, what might happen? I'm confused there.
So really going back to that essential confusion, like if I get out of my child's business, that means I don't care. Mm. So sometimes people are reluctant to imagine life without a painful thought, because they think that's all that holds me, you know, to this person in this situation. And if I let go of this thought, then that's going to mean I don't care.
You have just articulated my entire motherhood struggle, right? Is I just thought, if I don't involve myself in these micro moments, my children won't know how much I love them. They won't feel like I cared about who they became as humans.
Well, are you willing to look at this moment without the thought, my son should eat the food I prepare?
Yes.
Okay, so that's question 4. Rebecca, in the same exact moment, you're still alone, your budget is tight, you're being as creative and thoughtful and healthy as you can be, and this boy, this sweet little boy, is playing with the food instead of eating it. Who would you be in this same moment without the thought, my son should eat the food I prepare?
I would be laughing hysterically. He was so funny. He was so funny, especially that day. Boy, it's a stretch to imagine that it would be okay to just surrender and laugh at that moment. But that's, if I didn't have access to that thought that he should eat his food, I would only be able to see how sweet and funny he was being. Mm-hmm. And I would just feel so much tenderness for that sweet little boy.
Okay, so what happens in your body, Rebecca, when you are without the thought?
all that tightness goes away. Yeah, I lean back in my chair. I'm comfortable. I'm laughing. My head is getting thrown back. I might even throw some of the food up in the air myself because it's so silly.
And so it sounds like a much lighter moment. How do you treat him when you are without the thought, my son should eat the food I prepare?
This is so interesting because I respect his appetite. I respect his desire to eat or not eat. Mm-hmm. And it's not just respect, but in comes a little bit of trust. And what I'm noticing in this moment is I didn't have the capacity to trust my children at that stage of my life. Yeah. But as I reflect on this moment, and I mean, it's so easy, right? Because my kids are grown and thriving. And of course, my son eats all that he needs to and more. And we talk about healthy food all the time. So it's easy for me to trust now. But I think back to that 30-something young mom that I was. And I actually can feel in my body how leaning back in that chair allows me to just trust him. He was a kid who played and played and played. So he had to develop an appetite at some level. And I would have just trusted that, well, I guess he'll be hungry the next time.
And how does that feel in your body?
Well, it's just soft. And it is, if the feeling I had before was sort of this hovering, controlling, like I'm the umbrella that's going to control the very atmosphere of air that you breathe, this feeling is like giving him his own sky and his own air to breathe. And that's why it feels a little scary, because I didn't identify that that's what love felt like when I was growing up. Love felt like that heavy hand that told me I should be grateful for the food I was given. And so I'm having to learn a whole different thing in my body to know that this freedom, that I'm panicked that this freedom of me just going, you have your own air, you eat your own food, you make your own decisions, that it doesn't feel like love because I don't associate those feelings of freedom with love. Isn't that interesting, Allison? I mean, come on. I know differently now, but I didn't know differently when I was 30-something.
No, nor did I. And I think that that's one of the things that they do for us, our children.
Yes.
It's they teach us what they teach us what we need to know for the next stage of our evolution. They teach us what they need. Mm-hmm. And it helps us as well.
Yeah.
So just one last question before we turn the thought around. How do you treat yourself without the thought?
Well, I can tell you that it would have been a lot easier in that house because I put so much pressure on myself in those days. I mean, I was working like a maniac and hardly sleeping and still had these sky-high expectations of myself. And if I could have just gone, well, you'll eat when you eat, I would have had a completely different relationship with making food. Isn't that funny?
It's actually sounds predictable to me. I mean, that you were putting a lot of pressure on yourself and freighting food with just a lot, freighting yourself with a lot.
Freighting. Tell me
freight,
what you...
Like adding freight, like F-R-E-I-G-H-T, like a load.
It was loaded. Food was the loaded thing. I had to do this as a mom. And if I let go of that thought, I am unfreighted. I'm like just completely unencumbered. And my job is just to feed myself and make sure there's food available and keep playing.
Well, you know, one that may be for some, but I have a hunch that you wouldn't have taken your hand completely off the tiller, as it were, mixing metaphors. I suspect you, I think there's a middle path, you know, between a total
abandonment
and control. You know, I think there's a middle path. For example, to say in that moment, oh, I guess you're not hungry. I'm going to put this in the refrigerator. And when you're hungry, you tell me, you know, but it's going to have to be before bedtime. So, hey, don't want you to go to bed hungry, or, you know, something that you, that would be authentic for you to say.
Yeah.
So let's turn the thought around. And there are three ways to turn it around to the opposite. Let's start with the opposite. So my son should eat the food I prepare. How do you turn it around to the opposite?
My son should not eat the food I prepare.
Okay, so how might that be true?
Because he's not hungry, or because he doesn't like it, or because he knows his own body and I don't know his body, and I want him to learn to recognize his body's signals.
Wow. That was easy for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all right, then let's go to another turnaround. Turn it around to the self. So in place of my son, say I
should eat the food I prepare. Oh, golly, this one hits today. Like, sometimes I don't want to eat what I make. How silly is that?
Oh, so one of my favorite things that Byron Katie says is, if it's so great, you do it. So if eating the food you prepare is so great, you do it.
Right. Yeah.
If even you sometimes don't want to do it.
Yeah.
What are you modeling for him?
Right. And that I should shove food in my mouth that I don't want. Yeah. Or that I should make food because I think it's what I should want to eat, but then I don't eat it. And then I feel bad that it gets wasted and I go and I eat something else anyway. And what a cycle. Oh my gosh, Allison, that is a riot. How many years later and still this moment is teaching me?
Yeah. You know, last time when we were talking about, you know, the glass that your husband should pick up, and I probably said that same Byron Katie quote, if it's so great, you do it.
Right.
And I talked about cheerful self-responsibility. You know, if you see that glass and it bothers you, girlfriend, be kind to yourself and you take care of it. And you're going to feel good about yourself. You're going to feel good about the room as you look at it. And nothing about that glass getting picked up is going to be heavy. Everyone who's paying any attention, and our kids are always paying attention to us, anyone who's paying attention is going to notice, wow, picking up glasses is where it's at. Or eating mom's food is where it's at. Look how she tucks into it and enjoys it. Eating food must be fun.
But here's the thing is, I didn't, when he was a little boy, I didn't enjoy food. So I get to see that moment and see that I was making it work. And he was teaching me, food shouldn't be about work. Ah, isn't that gorgeous?
Oh my gosh, Rebecca. You were talking about a mirror before.
Yeah.
There it was.
There it is. Ah, Allison. Thank you for including me so deeply and trusting the conversation. Thank you.
Oh, Rebecca, it's my pleasure, always.
That's it for today. I'm Rebecca Mullen, and this has been Habits for Your Happily Ever After, where we get clear about your marriage communication. Because when your relationships are strong, you're better able to concentrate at work, reduce conflict at home, and receive support for your dreams, so you can have the courage to live your best life. If you enjoyed this podcast, I'd be grateful if you'd send a link to your friend. Habits for Your Happily Ever After is produced by Grace Smith. All our music and sound comes from Walk West Productions. I'm Rebecca Mullen. Thanks for including me in your relationship today.